Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Despite a push from the governor for more money, lawmakers have announced they plan to spend no dollars on economic incentives in the coming year.
Some things had to give, and that just seemed to be a place where we didn't have the levels of support necessary to stay over time.
Also tonight, both ends of the Florida Capitol labor to bring their school spending plans into closer agreement.
And so no individual items can be closed out unless the House is prepared to accept the Senate contingent offer in its entirety.
We'll also hear updates on bills to impose new abortion restrictions, reduce the state's prison population, and keep kids in school buses safer. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's the start of week 8 of the 9-week Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Even before this year's lawmaking session began way back in early January, sometimes seems like many months ago, Governor Scott was telegraphing his major legislative priorities loud and clear. First off, he wanted $1 billion in tax cuts. And second of all, he wanted lawmakers to set aside $250 million for economic development. Despite that request from Governor Scott for $250 million this year, there's not much money showing up in the Enterprise Florida budget. And we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
The plan so far includes an operating budget for the state's Economic Development Agency, but House Budget Chair Richard Corcoran says there won't be much more.
The Enterprise Fund is at zero.
The Enterprise Fund is at zero, Corcoran says, meaning the agency will get no new dollars to attract business to the state. Senate Budget Committee Chair Tom Lee says after officials received news they'd be getting less revenue than estimators had originally predicted, state leaders realized they'd have to make compromises.
We both came off the floor in different, very different places in terms of priorities as we worked through those against the clock. It became pretty clear that if we were going to get out of here on time and get back home, that some things had to give. And that just seemed to be a place where we didn't have the levels of support necessary to stay over time to continue to fight. So ultimately, we've worked something out in between as an interplay between the tax package and the economic development package, and we're off and running.
The decision not to fund most of Enterprise Florida's incentive programs is a move that surprised some, like Clearwater Republican Senator Jack Latvala. He chairs the Senate Transportation, Tourism, and Economic Development Appropriations Committee, which oversees the Enterprise Florida portion of the budget.
You know, I was here when Enterprise Florida started back in the late 90s when it took over for the Department of Commerce. I cannot possibly anticipate that we're going to have, you know, we're not going to have some sort of economic development program to compete with the other states that are trying to get businesses to relocate. It didn't have to be $250 million, but there's a big difference between $250 million and zero.
Latvala says the agency's big ask might have impacted the decision to zero out the enterprise budget. Meanwhile, enterprise officials, who have been raising concerns about running out of money throughout the process, have sent a letter warning officials that without funds to attract new businesses, the state stands to lose more than 50,000 potential jobs from 277 projects the agency is currently working to attract to the state. But Latvala points out the group does have money in its escrow account, which is used to pay businesses enterprise has attracted to the state once they meet certain job growth benchmarks.
But I really believe it's time for creative thinking on how we get out of this mess.
Some have asked whether the move could attract the governor's veto pen after lawmakers pass the budget. And Corcoran says it could, but he adds that's part of the process.
He's used the veto pen strongly in the past. He could in all likelihood use it again. I mean, he's the executive branch. We're the legislature. We're going to pass a budget and do what we think is right for the people of the state of Florida. He's going to use his executive power to do what he thinks is best for the state of Florida. And that's the way it works.
Meanwhile, the chairs of the Transportation, Tourism, and Economic Development Appropriation Committees have a few more issues to work out, like funding for the state's tourism arm, Visit Florida. The chairs say they expected any remaining issues to get bumped to budget chairs Corcoran and Lee by the end of the day Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
With near overwhelming support from both the executive and legislative branches of state government, one piece of the Florida budget that seemed most likely to grow in size this year was education spending. The only sticking point was, who was going to wind up paying for it? Florida homeowners could be in for a bit of a break when it comes for paying for their hometown public schools. Len Hatter reports a plan to swap a local property tax increase for more state dollars is coming closer to reality. That as lawmakers try to hammer out a budget plan within the next 2 weeks.
Early on, Florida lawmakers floated the idea of holding parts of the property tax study in exchange for putting more state dollars into education. Here's Representative Keith Perry.
We, the state, tell the locals that when they keep the same millage rate and the values go up, they have to call it a tax increase. But we, the state, seem to have the attitude that if we keep the same millage rate and the values go up, we don't call it a tax increase.
The reasoning? The state should be paying a larger share for its local public schools. The Florida legislature is looking at putting $430 million into the budget to shrink the local share of school funding. And Senate President Don Gates argues that money could be better spent and have a more widespread impact if it helped bring down costs for homeowners.
If we can reduce what otherwise would be a significant increase in local property taxes, that needs to be, in my view, part of the framework of discussion about holding tax increases down.
That argument has won out as the legislature begins negotiating the terms of the state budget. House and Senate education negotiators Gates and Representative Eric Frezen moved to make that a reality.
On page 4 for early learning services, not much change there. Just on line 37-0, a modified offer for the web-based language and literacy tool as far as how it was defined. On page 5 for the FEFP, the House acknowledges the House and Senate FEFP calculations are identical, and we just need to work on fund sources. I propose authorizing the staff to work out the technical differences of the fund sources themselves, and we will work out the non-recurring funding issues when we settle the funding for the Best and Brightest program.
FEFP is the funding formula used by the state for education. But as Frezen outlined areas where the two chambers agree, he hit a snag.
Mr. Chairman, point of order. The Senate offer number one was an offer, a contingent offer in its entirety. And so no individual items can be closed out unless the House is prepared to accept the Senate contingent offer in its entirety.
In short, it's all or nothing. That's Gates again. The state's budget is laid out on a spreadsheet, and each line represents an issue. The places where lawmakers disagree are where compromises have to be reached. And Gates in the Senate offered one plan to address all those areas. But as noted by Frezen, the House did not accept everything. Later, the two men were asked about where the discrepancies are. Here's Frezen.
It wasn't so much a matter of accepting. There were a significant number of areas in the contingency offer that we were able to meet. We delineated a bunch of those that we were able to meet. There was still some problem with arithmetic, how I could figure out the math from one point to another. Most of the issues, although the entire budget's getting bumped, are closer than what it would seem.
What is certain is that overall education funding will be getting an increase, and local homeowners could get some property tax relief. But everything else is still moving around. So now the process gets bumped to the next step. That's the desks of House Appropriations Chairman Richard Corcoran and Senate Appropriations Chairman Tom Lee. Any issues left unresolved there go to Senate President Andy Gardner and House Speaker Steve Crisafulli to resolve. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A Senate committee today continued moving forward with a plan aimed at ending years of legal fights with counties about sharing juvenile detention costs. But Senate sponsor Jack Latvala, Republican of Clearwater, said a key will be getting all counties subject to the cost to agree to drop litigation and create what he called a clean slate. Latvala told the Senate Rules Committee that all but two counties have agreed to such a condition, although he didn't identify the counties. The dispute affects 38 counties, with the remaining 29 considered fiscally constrained, so they aren't required to contribute to juvenile detention costs. The bill would restructure the cost-sharing system for juvenile detention costs, leading to a 50-50 split between the affected counties and the state. The legal fights in recent years have centered on arguments that the state has shifted too much of the tab for juvenile detention to the counties. The bill would reduce the county's share from this year's $54 million price tag to a bit more than $42 million next fiscal year. Today's approval by the Rules Committee prepares the bill to go to the full Senate. Still to come on Capitol Report, after an appeals court ruling, an abortion waiting period has taken effect, and lawmakers are already working on more restrictions.
The women were distraught, and most of them were in tears, and it was really going to be a struggle for many of them.
While many in the Florida legislature seem willing to roll back some of the harshest laws from the state's old get tough on crime days, some lawmakers are still reluctant to loosen the rules.
The current law is really, really clean hands. And Representative Bose's bill wants to allow a little bit of, I'm not going to say dirt, I'm going to say a little bit of relaxation of that.
And as Gabby's Law heads to the Senate floor, proponents of the original school bus safety bill are none too happy.
We needed those cameras. We had to have them. And by passing that amendment, we just said to every family in the state of Florida, your child's life doesn't matter. My daughter mattered.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by The Able Trust, 25 years of connecting businesses with workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to interview and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.
The question of abortion policy is at the center of legislative and judicial debates playing out in Florida. Nick Evans reports a 24-hour waiting period may be on its way to the Supreme Court, while lawmakers propose new, more stringent restrictions.
Last week, the First District Court of Appeal overturned a trial court ruling that put the state's 24-hour waiting period on hold. Central to the court's reasoning is the judge at the lower level didn't provide enough evidence for the ruling.
I'm particularly troubled. I'm looking at page 10 of the order that the trial court says that because he has no evidence, he's going to conclude that the second trip, he can't conclude that it is not an additional burden. It's like a double negative.
That's Appeals Court Judge Susan Kelsey. The ruling says a temporary injunction, the legal mechanism putting the waiting period on hold, is an extraordinary measure, and courts shouldn't impose one without showing the evidence is necessary. Now the waiting period is in effect. American Civil Liberties Union lawyer Julia Kay says this violates the constitutional rights of Florida women, and her client, the owner of Gainesville Woman Care, is already seeing the effects.
And as she explained in her affidavit, the women were distraught, and most of them were in tears. And it was really going to be a struggle for many of them, and perhaps impossible for some of them, to make it back to the clinic another day in the next week or two to actually have the procedure performed.
That's part of the argument Kay's making to the First District Court in hopes of again shelving the waiting period while the state Supreme Court decides whether to take the case.
We are optimistic that the Florida Supreme Court will agree to review the decision allowing this intrusive, demeaning law to take effect. And we believe that the First District Court should stay its order until the state high court has had an opportunity to weigh in on this important constitutional question.
Meanwhile, in the state Senate, Lakeland Republican Kelly Stargell is forging ahead with new restrictions for facilities performing abortions.
These protections require all abortion clinics to have a transfer agreement or admitting privileges at a hospital in the case of an emergency, and it prohibits public funds from being expended to a licensed facility performing abortions on babies that are not conceived through rape, incest, or to preserve the life of the pregnant mother, requires abortion.
The bill's largely modeled after Texas legislation passed in 2013 that dramatically reduced the number of abortion providers in that state. A constitutional challenge of that law goes before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. In the wake of a series of highly edited videos, Florida's law also takes aim at Planned Parenthood. Stargell's measure redefines trimesters after a dispute last year between Planned Parenthood and state regulators. Trimesters would be counted from the point of fertilization, rather than the last menstrual cycle. But fertilization is hard to pin down, and Lake Worth Democratic Senator Jeff Clemens says there's no scientific reason for the change.
We have a bill that redefines gestation period. No compelling medical reason in to be able to do that. No advice from medical doctors to be able to do that. But as was said in an answer to question here in committee, just a decision of the bill sponsor those are the dates we wanted to pick.
The move means more abortions would fall in the second trimester under stricter rules. Miami Democratic Senator Gwen Margolis was critical as well, but she was a bit more forceful.
With abortion, we should put vasectomy right next to it. Right next to it, so men understand how you feel when you're told you can't do this.
Despite their objections, Stargell's measure passed committee. Now it's on its way to the Senate floor. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
The Republican-led Florida legislature is reconsidering some of the harshest get-tough-on-crime measures that were adopted decades ago. But advocates for the wrongfully incarcerated are still meeting considerable conservative resistance, as we hear from Jim Ash.
Possession of a Quaalude is a felony. Getting caught with a single pill was enough to deny state compensation to William Dillon, a man who served decades behind bars for a murder he did not commit. Senate Democratic Leader Arthenia Joyner of Tampa doesn't think that's fair.
Someone like William Dillon, who after 26 years in prison for a murder he did not commit, could not seek compensation because he had a past conviction for drug possession. It is time we address this inequitable situation.
Joyner sponsored the 2008 law spelling out how Florida compensates the wrongfully convicted. To get it passed, she had to agree to the so-called clean hands provision that disqualifies anyone with a felony record. It was a bitter pill to swallow, so to speak, but Joyner also knew the only other option, the claims process, was worse.
No procedure in place for persons who have been wrongfully incarcerated to be compensated other than the claims process, which is not completely, somewhat subjective.
The claims process is a roll of the dice for victims seeking compensation from government wrongs. It requires the legislature to pass a separate bill, and it can take a decade. Now, at least the wrongfully incarcerated can get $50,000 for each year behind bars, up to $2 million. Four people have qualified, and the state has paid out $4.3 million so far. This year, Joyner wants to open the door just a crack to include people with a nonviolent felony record.
This bill does not eliminate the clean hands provision. Under this bill, a wrongfully incarcerated person is prohibited from receiving compensation if they committed a prior violent felony.
The cautious approach has won the support of colleagues like Senator Rob Bradley, a conservative Republican from Fleming Island.
A day, 2 days, year in jail, you can't pay that back. All we got is money. So this is just the right thing to do, and it's completely consistent with someone like myself who is a believer in the Constitution and the rights it gives us all.
But over in the House, it's been a slog. Late last week, Representative Bobby DuBose of Fort Lauderdale presented a slightly different companion measure to the House Judiciary Committee. It would have compensated victims of wrongful incarceration with a nonviolent felony record, but it excludes repeat offenders.
Under this bill, a wrongfully incarcerated person is prohibited from receiving compensation if they committed a prior violent felony, committed a violent felony while they were in prison, or if they committed a violent felony while they were on parole or community supervision and committed multiple nonviolent felonies.
That still didn't please Republican Representative John Wood of Winter Haven. Wood offered a last-minute amendment that would have disqualified people who have committed some nonviolent felonies.
The current law is really, really clean hands, and Representative DeBose's bill wants to allow a little bit of, I'm not going to say dirt, I'm going to say a little bit of relaxation of that.
Wood's amendment failed after DeBose complained it would gut his bill. And advocates for the wrongfully incarcerated said DeBose's bill is too stingy. Mike Graves, a public defender for the 5th Judicial Circuit in Central Florida, said people who committed the most minor offenses would be left out in the cold.
We're talking individuals with a pill and a felony driving with license suspended that arises out of an economic circumstance, a worthless check, and possession of 25 grams of marijuana.
DeBose's bill would only apply to future cases. Legislative analysts say it's not clear how much either bill would cost taxpayers. Both are headed for their respective floors. The differences will have to be worked out. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Several legislative meetings are on tomorrow's Capitol calendar. Ronald J. Evan has a preview.
The Senate Ethics Committee meets at 8:30 Tuesday morning and will take up a number of bills, including confirmation of executive appointments, including another stab at confirming Health Secretary Dr. John Armstrong. At 10 o'clock, the Senate Appropriations Committee will take up a number of bills, including a measure that would help retired law enforcement dogs. There's also the Healthy Food Financing Initiative, a bill that provides for a multi-state nursing license, and the Seminole Tribe Compact. The House goes into session at 10:30. Among the bills to be voted on are a needle exchange program for Miami-Dade County, a bill allowing nursing practitioners and physician's assistants to prescribe different categories of drugs. There's the Pastor Protection Act that protects religious organizations and churches from marrying someone against their religious beliefs. Those are some of the highlights in the legislature for Tuesday, March 1st. I'm Ronald J. Eben.
Finally tonight, a bill that enhances the penalties for passing a stop school bus is heading to the Senate floor after passing its last committee today. But as Sasha Cordner reports, proponents of Gabby's Law aren't too happy with a recent change to the original bill.
There is already a new law in the books called Gabby's Law for Student Safety. It requires school districts to identify hazardous walking conditions for students. Now Donald Marr is hoping another law called Gabby's Law for School Bus Stop Safety will pass the Florida legislature.
The bill was named after my daughter. She was killed at her school bus stop.
In 2010, Gabby lost her life at the age of 12 after she was hit by a car when she exited the school bus in Volusia County. Altamont Springs Republican David Simmons is carrying the Senate bill.
1570 reclassifies the offense of passing a school bus on the right side where children enter and exit from a non-criminal moving violation to reckless driving offense.
But to the disappointments of proponents of the original bill, Simmons changed the measure.
It also previously authorized the use of cameras. In the original bill, it does that as a recording device that is being deleted.
Simmons says he made that call at the request of Republican Senator Jeff Brandis, who chairs the Senate Transportation Committee, also the bill's first hearing. Brandis has long been an opponent of red light cameras and is carrying a bill in the Senate to repeal them. It's currently stalled. But Miami Gardens Democratic Senator Oscar Brainin questioned why Brandis's views on red light cameras had entered into the school bus stop safety debate.
I've heard his objections to it, and I am trying to juxtapose those onto the cameras on the side of a school bus, because the cameras on the side of a school bus stop someone from running over a child. Period. That's it. That's what it does. If I'm not mistaken, if I know your bill well, because I did it for 4 years, it is activated when the bus driver pops open that door and pushes that button. So it's out, it's manually activated by the driver. This is not something that's sitting there, and if you happen to pull up or the light is too quick.
It's a great question.
While Brandis called it a good question, he says he would speak to Brandon privately. Still, Brandon says he's going to work to get the cameras included back in. Donald Marr wasn't too happy either. He says the cameras are needed in order for the law to be enforced as well as save lives.
I can't believe you passed that amendment. So what we have now is an unenforceable law. That's because our law requires a law enforcement officer to witness the infraction. Florida Department of Education says there's over 14,000 school buses on our roads every day, twice a day. And so a law enforcement officer cannot follow around each bus and protect our children. And that's why kids in our state are constantly being run over.
Andy says state studies support his views.
We needed those cameras. We had to have them. And by passing that amendment, we just said to every family in the state of Florida, your child's life doesn't matter. Because right here, Florida Department of Education, the government agency, says 10,987 motorists in one day passed stop school buses. One day. My daughter mattered. She was just run over doing the most basic thing, walking to, going to and from school. We needed it to protect our kids. And now, if we try it again next year in this 12-month period, I guarantee you that 12 more kids are going to die because we didn't get it done this time.
But Brandis says despite his views on the issue, he feels for Marr as a parent.
Mr. Marr, as a father, I'm incredibly sorry for your loss. I know that there's nothing that we can do or say that will ease that pain. And I just really appreciate your testimony and your advocacy on this issue.
And the measure passed Brandis's as well as other committees unanimously. Now it's off to the Senate floor. Meanwhile, its House companion has already cleared its first hearing. It had one stop before heading to the floor. But Orlando Democratic Representative Victor Torres says his bill appears stalled. Not only does it differ from the Senate version as it includes the cameras, Torres says the chairman of the bill's last committee hearing had problems with enhancing the penalties for violations. So Torres says if it dies, he hopes to bring the bill back next year. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Kortner, Ronald J. Eben, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And join us each weeknight during the 2016 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart & Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman & Walker, a law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. And from HR Florida State Council, representing 16,000 human resource professionals and 6,300 Florida employers. HR Florida State Council, a resource for workplace best practices for the media, lawmakers, and Florida's human resource professionals. HRFlorida.org. WFSU-FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.